Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, August 31st, 2025. First, an update on the satellite NISAR ISRO. It was launched on July 30th from India's southeastern coast. 17 days after NISAR's launch, an essential piece of science hardware has unfurled in orbit. The photo. The NISAR satellite uses a radar antenna reflector that's 39 feet or 12 meters in diameter to gather information about Earth's changing surface. The mission scans nearly all the planet's land and ice surfaces twice every 12 days. Spanning 39 feet, the drum-shaped antenna reflector on the NISAR, NASA ISRO, Synthetic Aperture Radar, satellite mission from NASA and the Indian Space Research Organization, ISRO, successfully unfurled in low Earth orbit. The reflector had been stowed umbrella-like until the 30-foot boom that supports it could be deployed and locked in place. Launched by ISRO on July 30, 2025, from the Satish Dhawan Space Center on India's southeastern coast, NISAR will track the motion of ice sheets and glaciers, the deformation of land due to earthquakes, volcanoes, and landslides, and changes in forest and wetland ecosystems, down to fractions of an inch. It also will aid decision makers in fields as diverse as disaster response, infrastructure monitoring, and agriculture. The successful deployment of NISAR's reflector marks a significant milestone in the capabilities of the satellite, said Karen Saint-Germain, Director, Earth Science Division at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C. From innovative technology to research and modeling, to delivering science to help inform decisions, the data NISAR is poised to gather will have a major impact on how global communities and stakeholders improve infrastructure, prepare for and recover from natural disasters, and maintain food security. NISAR mission team members at NASA JPL, or the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, working with colleagues in India, executed the deployment of the satellite's radar antenna reflector on August 15, 2025. The reflector directs microwave impulses from NISAR's two radars toward Earth and receives the return signals. The mission carries the most sophisticated radar systems ever launched as part of a NASA mission. In a first, the satellite combines two synthetic aperture radar, or SAR, systems, an L-band system that can see through clouds and forest canopy, and an S-band system that can see through clouds as well, but is more sensitive to light vegetation and moisture in snow. The reflector plays a key role for both systems, which is why the successful deployment of the hardware is such a significant milestone. This is the largest antenna reflector ever deployed for a NASA mission, and we were, of course, eager to see the deployment go well. It's a critical part of the NISAR Earth Science mission and has taken years to design, develop, and test to be ready for this big day, said Phil Barella, NISAR project manager at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California, which managed the U.S. portion of the mission and provided one of the two radar systems aboard NISAR. Now that we've launched, we are focusing on fine-tuning it to begin delivering transformative science by late fall of this year, 2025. How Bloom works. Weighing about 142 pounds, or 64 kilograms, the reflector features a cylindrical frame made of 123 composite struts and a gold-plated wire mesh. On August 9th, the satellite's boom, which had been tucked close to its main body, started unfolding one joint at a time until it was fully extended about 4 days later. The reflector assembly is mounted at the end of the boom. Then, on August 15th, small explosive bolts that held the reflector assembly in place were fired, enabling the antenna to begin a process called the bloom. It's unfurling by the release of tension stored in its flexible frame, while stowed like an umbrella. Subsequent activation of motors and cables then pulled the antenna into its final locked position. NISAR team members at JPL, along with colleagues at ISRO facilities in India, deployed the satellite's radar antenna reflector. Depicted in a photo, the reflector unfurled from 2 feet, or 0.6 meters, across in its stowed configuration to its full size, 39 feet, or 12 meters, in 37 minutes. To image Earth's surface down to pixels about 30 feet or 10 meters across, the reflector was designed with a diameter about as wide as a school bus is long. Using SAR processing, NISAR's reflector simulates a traditional radar antenna that, for the mission's L-band instrument, would have to be 12 miles or 19 kilometers long to achieve the same resolution. Synthetic aperture radar, in principle, works like the lens of a camera, which focuses light to make a sharp image. The size of the lens, called the aperture, determines the sharpness of the image, said Paul Rosen, NISAR's project scientist at JPL. Without SAR, spaceborne radars could generate data, but the resolution would be too rough to be useful. With SAR, NISAR will be able to generate high-resolution imagery. Using special interferometric techniques that compare images over time, NISAR enables researchers and data users to create 3D movies of changes happening on Earth's surface, he said. The NISAR satellite is the culmination of decades of space-based radar development at JPL. Starting in the 1970s, JPL managed the first Earth-observing SAR satellite, CSAT, which launched in 1978, as well as Magellan, which used SAR to map the cloud-shrouded surface of Venus in the 1990s. More about NISAR. The NISAR mission is a partnership between NASA and ISRO, spanning years of technical and programmatic collaboration. The successful launch and deployment of NISAR builds upon a strong heritage of cooperation between the United States and India in space. The data produced by NISAR's two radar systems, one provided by NASA and one by ISRO, will be a testament to what can be achieved when countries unite around a shared vision of innovation and discovery. The ISRO Space Applications Center provided the mission's S-band SAR. The UR Rao Satellite Center provided the spacecraft bus. Launch services were through Satish Dhawan Space Center. After launch, key operations, including boom and radar antenna reflector deployment, are being executed and monitored by the ISRO Telemetry, Tracking and Command Networks, global system of ground stations. Managed by Caltech in Pasadena, JPL leads the U.S. component of the project. In addition to the L-band SAR, reflector, and boom, JPL also provided the high-rate communication subsystem for science data, a solid-state data recorder, and payload data subsystem. NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, manages the Near Space Network, which receives NISAR's L-band data. To learn more about NISAR, you can visit NISAR, which is N-I-S-A-R, .jpl.nasa, NASA.gov. Next, from the New York Times, the story of an incredible journey. With dams removed from the Klamath River, a group of indigenous youth is on a journey to descend the full length through Oregon and California. The article was written by John Branch, reporting from the Klamath River. It was published on June 17, 2025, and updated the next day, June 18, 2025. The remote and rugged Klamath River in Oregon and California, one of the mightiest in the American West and an ancient lifeline to indigenous tribes, is running free again, mostly for the first time in 100 years after the recent removal of four major dams. At the burbling aquifer near Chiloquin, Oregon, that is considered the headwaters, a sacred spot for Native people, a group of kayakers, mostly indigenous youth from the river's vast basin, began to paddle on Thursday, June 12th. Ages 13 to 20, they had learned to kayak for this moment. Stroke by stroke, mile by mile, day by day, they planned to reach the salty water of the rugged Northern California coast, more than 300 miles away, by mid-July. These young native kayakers practiced on one of the newly flowing sections of the river ahead of the expedition. This group of young kayakers represented six tribes along the Klamath River. Most of them had never been in a kayak before preparing for this expedition. If all goes as planned, the kayakers were going to pass the rehabilitated sites of the largest dam removal project in U.S. history. They would pass salmon swimming upstream in places that the fish had not been able to reach since the early 1900s. They would pass through the ancient territory of their tribes, the Klamath, Shasta, Karuk, Hoopa Valley, and Yurok among them. And when they reached the wide mouth of the river at the Pacific Ocean near Klamath, California, they planned to celebrate as the first to descend the full length of the Klamath, source to sea, since the dams went up and pinched life from the water. "I'm really excited to be on the river with friends, celebrating this huge accomplishment that our people have been fighting for forever," said Ruby Rain Williams, aged 18, of the Karuk tribe. The sky was blue. The mood was, at turns, celebratory and solemn. The colorful kayaks glided across a pool of crystal water, headed downstream. "Water flows again." An elder from the Klamath tribes blessed the expedition with the burning root of wild celery and the feathers of a hawk. Tonawan Jaden Daus, a 15-year-old from the Hoopa Valley tribe, bounced through a Class 4 rapid that didn't exist a year ago in a narrow canyon where one of the dams fell. Ruby followed, emerging from a stretch of steep white water with a wide grin. The expedition was 2 days away. Scouting the difficult section of rapids from a raft, Kia Wiki, a 17-year-old Yurok, whooped at her new friends. All three grew up along the water in different tribes, hearing stories of ancestors who could walk across the Klamath on the backs of so many salmon. Today, everyone was more likely to get dinner from a local convenience store than from the river. The arrival of white settlers, starting with a group of beaver trappers in 1826, interrupted the rhythms of life here for the next 200 years. Gold miners and timber companies came. Farmers and ranchers arrived, sucking and diverting water from the river and draining the fish-rich wetlands near the headlands, the headwaters. The first hydroelectric dam, COPCO 1, named for the California-Oregon Power Company, was built in 1918. Others followed. COPCO 2 in 1925, J.C. Boyle in 1958, and Iron Gate in 1964. They were 400 vertical feet of water stoppers and lake makers within a 45-mile stretch straddling the Oregon-California border. Salmon had no way to get through. For decades, tribes and environmentalists, seeing and feeling an ecological and cultural disaster unfold, demanded the removal of dams and the restoration of the river. Voices went largely unheard until 2002, when tens of thousands of dead salmon and steelhead trout washed up on the lower banks of the river. The dam removal movement gained momentum, and politicians and other power brokers slowly acknowledged that the relatively low amounts of power generated by the dams in such a rural region was not enough reason to continue suffocating the river and its tributaries. In small creeks that feed into the upper Klamath, hundreds of miles from the ocean, Salmon were spotted 11 days after the last dam fell last fall in 2024. By then, a small group of river runners, having recruited and extensively trained about 36 indigenous teens growing up along the Klamath, had grand plans to be the first group to paddle the length of the freed river. Two smaller dams remain, upriver from the dismantled ones and not far from the headwaters. The paddlers had to portage around the dams. The tribes would like those dams gone as well. "Then all of our relatives can be connected again," said William Ray, Jr., the chairman of the Klamath Tribes, a consortium of the Klamath, Modoc, and Yahuskin people. On Tuesday, June 10th, some of those teens, preparing for the expedition and practicing their skills, paddled through a section that had been the floor of Kopko Lake for more than a century. They could see the fading shoreline of the old lake as the river found its old course. "Water has memory," tribal elders say. The Klamath River has been the lifeblood of tribes for thousands of years. Current generations know the river for its decline, largely from dams, and as a place to swim. On Riffling Current, the paddlers passed houses that had stood lakeside for decades, now sitting far from the river's edge, their old docks leading nowhere. They passed a graveyard of bald trees, still standing, that had been submerged for years. A boat anchor hung, tangled, on one of the naked gray limbs. Entering Kigachiki Canyon, they passed the site of Kopko 1. Almost all signs of the massive structure have been removed. This year's river runners might not realize it had been there just last summer. A few miles downriver, Kopko 2 once diverted all of the water out of the canyon, through tunnels and pipes, to a power station, where the water re-entered. For generations, the dam left a surreal dry stretch of riverbed in the heart of a twisting walled canyon lined by extraordinary columnar basalt formations. Alders and cottonwoods overtook the dry channel, threatening to clog the natural river route. Part of the restoration plan meant cutting down about 1,000 of the trees and airlifting them out of the canyon by helicopter. Now the river that had carved the stone canyon runs wild again. The teens looked up in wonder, and then they put their heads down and paddled. The team expected to reach the Pacific Ocean in mid-July. This would be after a 310-mile expedition that began not far from Crater Lake in Oregon, near the headwaters of the Klamath River Basin. Rush Sturges, 40, is a professional kayaker and filmmaker who grew up on California's Salmon River, a tributary of the Klamath. His parents ran a kayak school for 40 years. Mr. Sturges knew all about the fight to remove the dams. "But," he said, "I didn't know a single indigenous kayaker before this." In 2021, he met Weston Boyles, aged 38, the founder and executive director of Rios to Rivers, a global organization advocating indigenous youth and rivers around the world through education and exchange programs. They discussed life after the dams. "Shouldn't Native children be the first to paddle the full stretch of the reflowing river?" they asked themselves. And thus, the organization Paddle Tribal Waters was born. It soon recruited Danielle Frank, a 21-year-old Hoopa Valley tribe member known as Ducky, and a dynamo of activism and advocacy work in the Klamath Basin. She helped connect the organizers to the tribes. Despite deep and ancient connections to the river, most Native people along the Klamath had never been in a kayak. Kayaks were something that floated by, holding outsiders. White water was something to fear, not enjoy. "Recreation is a luxury that wasn't afforded to us," said John Acuna, 30, also a member of the Hoopa Valley tribe. 3 years after being introduced to kayaking, he became a certified instructor and a leader on the expedition. We have an opportunity to redefine what our relationship to the river is, he said. The long-term plan for Paddle Tribal Waters is to connect children to the rejuvenated river. Some students, like Jaden, one of the most talented kayakers I've ever seen learn the sport, Mr. Sturgis said, have organized kayak clubs in their tribes. The short-term plan was less philosophical. We wanted to train these kids to lead this first descent, Mr. Sturgis said. With stretches that include technical and dangerous Class 4 rapids, Class 6 is not navigable. The Klamath is not for novices. So Paddle Tribal Waters ran multi-week summer programs in 2022, 2023, and 2024, teaching 45 teens how to paddle whitewater. At night, they took tribe-led classes on activism, ecosystems, and cultural knowledge. Some then took part in semester-long school and paddle programs around the world. About 14 youth and 7 staff members planned to paddle the entire stretch of river. Another 30 or so teens planned to join the party midway. They planned to camp on the river's banks. And there would also be ceremonial meetings and meals with tribal members and families. Food and gear would be shuttled in at various access points, part of a coordinated and complex logistical challenge. Along the way, the young kayakers would be encouraged to help name rapids, maybe in native languages, so that the many commercial outfits that run the river in rafts and kayaks might adopt them. The group was scheduled to arrive at the Pacific Ocean ahead of a large-scale celebration on July 12th, and a symposium the next day. But that was still 300 miles and 30 days away. Scarlett Schroeder, 13, and Coley Miller, 14, who belonged to tribes on the Upper Klamath, daydreamed about reaching the ocean. "We're definitely going to go down in history," Scarlett said. "Our grandkids will know," Coley said. "Our great-great-great-grandkids will know," Scarlett said. On Thursday, June 12th at noon, at the headwaters near Chiloquin, Oregon, not far from Crater Lake National Park, the kayakers and supporters gathered in a circle near the water's edge. Leaders from the Klamath tribes took turns explaining the significance of the sacred journey. Many wore shirts that read, "Undammed." One wore a hat that read, "Make American Native Again." One leader told the group that she was nervous for the group to go, but knew that the paddlers were brave. A water song was sung. The smoking root of wild celery was passed and spread around the body of each paddler. Not all of the expedition would be rugged whitewater. The early days of the journey meant crossing Upper Klamath Lake and portaging around the 2 remaining dams on the river. Soon, the kayakers were sitting low in their colorful boats and pointed toward the open water. Jeff Mitchell, a former chairman of the Klamath tribes, leaned against a pine tree, holding a walking stick in one hand and eagle wing in the other. He had not known he would see this day. "Think of all the Yurok, Hoopa, Karuk, and Klamath people who worked on this for the last 30 years," he said. "It's amazing." A young couple wandered up, curious about what was going to happen. Mr. Mitchell explained the expedition, the dams coming down, the meaning of it all. "You're witnessing the first descent from the headwaters to the ocean," he said. The pair listened and nodded, and Mr. Miller smiled. On that Thursday, June 12th, the kayakers gathered in a circle in the water. They let out a collective shout, and then they began to paddle away. Soon they disappeared around the bend, headed for history. And on July 11th, 120 kayakers made history. As reported in the _Native News, Indigenous youth complete 310-mile Klamath River journey. The youth descended a free-flowing Klamath River after the biggest dam removal project in history. And the photo shows the 120 youth kayakers representing the Klamath, Yurok, Karuk, Quartz Valley, Hoopa Valley, Warm Springs, as well as the Tohono O'odham Nation, completing their historic 310-mile descent of the free-flowing Klamath River, culminating the largest dam removal project in history. And it is an amazing photo. There is fog on the river, and it's almost as if they are all paddling in sync. Over 100 family and community members gathered on the sand spit shore below Requa Village on the Yurok Reservation, where the Klamath River meets the Pacific Ocean, to welcome 120 Indigenous youth kayakers over that last 30 days, making history as the first people to descend over 310 miles down the free-flowing Klamath River. "This is an historical moment for us," said Susan Mastin, former Yurok Tribal Chair, past president of the National Congress of American Indians, and the president and co-founder of Women Empowering Women for Indian Nations. "We haven't had the opportunity yet to celebrate the dams coming down as a people. This moment in time with these youth that have traveled 30 days, the river has guided them down to us," said Mastin. It was a foggy morning as Mastin stood on the beach, eagerly awaiting to welcome her niece and the other kayakers. For more than a century, four hydroelectric dams blocked the Klamath, disrupting once abundant salmon runs and disconnecting Indigenous communities from the river that they have lived along since time immemorial. The last of those dams were removed in the fall of last year, marking the completion of the largest dam removal project in history. "The most significant and important thing about it is that the river is healing," said Mastin. "The river remembers," she added. "The fish are coming back to spawn where they haven't been able to be in 100+ years. The fish remember. We, as this river system, are healing." On June 12th, the kayakers began their journey. They made the long-awaited dream of the Klamath Basin tribes a reality once they entered the mouth of the river. "There have been generations of individuals and tribes who have been fighting this fight," said Mastin. "Our ancestors have provided safety for them on their journey. We are just excited and want them to feel like we are honoring them, because they have provided international and national attention to our river and the importance of having a free-flowing river. They have inspired millions to be advocating and fighting for their own rivers and their homelands." More than 3 years of preparation led to this moment, as youth traveled to places like Chile, Costa Rica, Canada, and Africa to train and learn how to navigate whitewater with kayak instructors from the Paddle Tribal Waters Program, part of the nonprofit Rios to Rivers. As mothers helped their children dress into traditional Yurok regalia, deerskin skirts adorned with rows of abalone and shells, placing Yurok hat baskets atop their heads, and more, the sound of drums and songs blended with the cheers of those on shore as the bright neon-colored kayaks emerged from the fog, led by two traditional redwood dugout canoes. "I look up and I see so many family members there, and so many community members, and my grandparents and everybody, and someone who's like my uncle singing his song and drumming for us. And I was like, oh my gosh, we're actually about to finish this. We actually did it," said Danielle Frank, Hoopa tribal member and Yurok descendant, director of development and community relations for Rios to Rivers. "It felt very scenic and very deep," said Frank, "like the river and the world was having this deep moment, welcoming us into this historic time and place." Smiles lit the faces of the kayakers as they reached the shore. They immediately jumped from their kayaks and sprinted through the lines of cheering people to the crashing waves of the Pacific Ocean. It's just a big moment in history and in everybody's lives, said 20-year-old Iskots Zoyan Scott of the Hoopa Valley tribe as she tried to catch her breath after celebrating in the ocean with the others. All of our families have been fighting for dam removal. Everybody's been fighting for us to be able to reach different parts of the river that we haven't been able to in over 150 years. So it's really so much. I can't even explain how I feel right now. On the beach, one elder was overcome with emotion watching the youth kayakers. She apologized to the people standing next to her. They told her that, "No, we can cry, Grandma. Crying is part of it. Crying is healing." After the landing, everyone jumped in kayaks, rafts, and boats to join tribal elders, community members, and family at the boat dock for a celebration. Youth and representatives took turns sharing about their experiences. "It's not just a river trip, and it's not just a descent to us," said Frank in her speech. "This whole trip is really a letter to our community. It's a letter of love, the love that has been shown to us our entire lives, the love we get to show to each other and ourselves that was wrapped into this trip. That's what built this trip, was knowing that we were loved enough to be supported to do something like this." "It's also a letter of promise," Frank continued. "We promise that we will do whatever we have to protect our free-flowing river now." And the reporter of this story, Jarrett Work, _Native News, is a multimedia journalist with experience in digital news, audio reporting, and photojournalism. He joined Underscore in June 2022 in partnership with the National Report for America program. The story of these kayakers is a gripping story. In our next article, we learn about the power of storytelling. Good storytellers are more likely to have a sense of purpose and to see the big picture, says Ron Shachar, who writes this article that appeared in the June 2025 issue of Scientific American in Mind Matters. He writes, "King Shahryar, betrayed by his wife, decides to marry a new woman each night and have her executed by morning, to ensure he is never deceived again. After Scheherazade volunteers to marry the king, she outsmarts him. She begins a gripping story every evening but stops telling it at dawn, leaving her husband eager for more. Night after night, she keeps him hooked with new tales. And over the course of 1,001 nights, he falls in love with her and abandons his cruel ways. This story is the frame of 1,001 Nights, a medieval collection of Middle Eastern folktales, including the stories of Aladdin, Ali Baba, and Sinbad, that highlight the power of storytelling. But can storytelling skills indeed save a person's life in the real world? The findings of recent research by my colleagues and me don't go that far yet, but they do show that strong storytelling skills can dramatically improve someone's well-being. This result hints that, yes, skillful storytellers may actually live longer. How exactly? You'll have to wait until the end of this story to find out. No peeking. Our journey starts with extensive research on narrative identity, showing that people make sense of who they are by shaping their life experiences into a story, one that gives their life meaning. The idea is that by connecting our experiences, we can recognize the guiding force that has shaped our journey. For instance, the belief that we like helping people, and in turn, uncover our sense of purpose and meaning in life. In our research, my colleagues and I shift the focus from stories, particularly life stories, to storytelling. We suggest that compared with others, skillful storytellers have a stronger sense of meaning in life and approach their experiences with what we call a why mindset. That is, they focus on their reasons for doing what they do, rather than just on how they do it. Our hypothesis about storytellers is rooted in the nature of stories. The typical narrative focuses on a hero who strives to achieve a goal, such as landing a job or winning someone's heart, while facing various obstacles and challenges along the way. Therefore, to excel at storytelling, individuals must develop two key skills. First, they need to connect the dots, the events of the story, in a meaningful way to create a coherent narrative. Secondly, they must learn to see the world through the eyes of their characters, understanding the why of what drives people. In applying these two skills to their own lives, talented storytellers use the first to identify and pursue what gives their life meaning, and the second to foster a mindset that prioritizes the why behind their actions over the how. To illustrate this point, let's imagine two people, Rachel and Monica. Both had the same career path, and both worked in multiple vastly different industries, including sports, medicine, and banking. Throughout their careers, they often acted on impulse. Rachel is a skillful storyteller, however, and Monica isn't. This difference comes across vividly when they reflect on their careers. Monica is more likely to feel lost and to lack clarity about her sense of meaning and purpose in life because she doesn't possess a why mindset, having always focused on how to get things done rather than the bigger picture. Rachel, in contrast, is inclined to reflect more deeply on her life and seek connections, such as the fact that in all her managerial jobs, she used her position to bolster the presence of women in decision-making roles. This observation gives her a sense of purpose and a deeper understanding of what drives her, that is, her why. But this story is just hypothetical. Does it pan out in real life? To examine how a skill for narrative serves storytellers, we conducted 5 studies with about 800 participants. To reliably measure storytelling ability, we took a multifaceted approach. First, we developed and tested a questionnaire in which we asked people how much they agreed with statements such as, "My stories usually excite my listeners." Secondly, we interviewed close friends of the participants about their storytelling skills. Third, we invited trios of strangers to our laboratory and asked them to share stories with one another. In our lab experiment, each participant told 2 distinct stories, one about a personal trait and one that incorporated 3 random words we provided, a task designed to isolate the core mechanics of storytelling. This approach is a significant departure from previous studies of life stories. Here, we are really homing in on the ability to craft a compelling narrative from minimal material. As part of the experiment, each participant rated the storytelling ability of the others in their trio, and afterward, storytelling experts, people who had just completed a course on the subject, reviewed video recordings of the sessions and provided independent ratings. Thus, we had 4 measures of storytelling skill. 1, people's self-reports of their own ability. 2, opinions of close friends. 3, ratings from other members of the trio in our lab experiment. And 4, evaluations from storytelling experts. In addition to these assessments, we asked participants questions to get a sense of how meaningful they found life and whether they approached decisions with a why mindset rather than a how mindset. Across all studies and measures, we consistently found that storytelling ability is linked to both a sense of meaning in life and a mindset focused on the whys. When we tested whether personality traits might be driving our findings, we found they weren't. That said, personality did add interesting nuance. People who are naturally open to new experiences tend to be better storytellers, for example. That makes sense. Such people are more likely to be part of unique and interesting events that lend themselves to great stories, and these encounters give these individuals more opportunities to refine their storytelling skills as they share their experiences with others. We also found that storytelling skills related to meaning in life for introverts more than they did for extroverts. In general, extroverts have a stronger sense of meaning in life, but storytelling may help introverts compensate for that difference. Both storytelling and extroversion are related to expressiveness. Extroversion is all about the urge to express yourself in social settings, whereas storytelling is about having a knack for doing so through stories. It turns out that either one of these tendencies can be enough to spark a sense of meaning and purpose. This work offers several lessons. First, because people with a why mindset, by definition, excel at seeing the big picture, our findings suggest that the abilities to tell stories well and to see the big picture are closely related. Although seeing the big picture is useful in its own right, it may also be a crucial advantage that humans have over artificial intelligence, which excels at executing microtasks. Thus, when we are facing an uncertain future, our ability to tell stories is something we should treasure and cultivate. My team's findings also suggest that storytelling workshops, which have grown popular in recent years, influence people's lives in ways that go beyond improving communication and persuasion. They may strengthen the driving force of our existence and sharpen our sense of direction in life. The benefits of cultivating greater purpose are many, and some of them are unexpected. Past research has found that a strong sense of meaning in life is associated with many health benefits, including a longer lifespan. Combined with our findings, this outcome suggests that storytelling may also contribute to better health and decreased mortality. Plus, storytelling helps people connect, which can naturally expand their social circles. Because strong social relationships are known to boost health and even influence longevity, it makes sense that storytelling could indirectly support physical health by fostering deeper and broader social ties. Perhaps 1001 Nights was correct all along. Storytelling may help to save your life. Roy Shachar is a professor of economics and business at Reichman University in Israel. He studies storytelling, big picture thinking, branding, advertising, and political campaigns. His article on the power of storytelling appears in the June 2025 issue of Scientific American. From Science News, the June 2025 issue. From the Department of Neuroscience, Babies Form Memories Like Adults Do, by Laura Sanders. A baby's early life has a lot of milestones: first giggle, first tooth, first step. A brain scanning study adds something to the list: first memory. Infants can form memories, and they use a memory structure in the brain called the hippocampus to do it, researchers reported in Science magazine. The results shore up the idea that memories can be made during the earliest years of life, though what happens to these memories as the days, weeks, and years roll by remains mysterious. What is really new in this paper is that it implicates the hippocampus in the encoding of early memories, says cognitive scientist Vladimir Slautsky of Ohio State University in Columbus, Ohio. And that's important, Slautsky says, because it shows the hippocampus is mature enough to encode early memories. Babies can be difficult research subjects. For the study, awake babies were kept calm in functional MRI scanners with a parent nearby and earphones to protect them from startling sounds. In the MRI scanner, babies who ranged in age from 4 months to nearly 25 months saw images, one after another, of people, places, or objects. All the while, scientists recorded blood flow in the brain, a proxy of neural activity. Occasionally, the babies were tested with a pair of images, one of which they had seen before. If the babies looked longer at the previously seen image, researchers reasoned, they likely remembered it. We can kind of quantify the strength of their memory based on how much they look at it, says study co-author Nick Turk-Brown a neuroscientist at Yale University. The trick in this sort of study is then go back and look at, when they first saw the picture, what was different in the brain for pictures that they later had a memory for versus that they later forgot. The difference, it turns out, was in the hippocampus, a seahorse-shaped structure, one on each side of the brain. In the study, 13 babies were younger than a year, and 13 babies were older than a year. When the older babies remembered an image, this memory feat corresponded to brain activity in a part of the hippocampus. The effect was weaker in the younger babies, the researchers found. The result adds to other evidence that babies can, in fact, form memories, and starts to answer how, says neuroscientist Christina Alberini of New York University. But it doesn't explain why we can't recall some of life's earliest moments, a phenomenon known as infantile amnesia. It's possible that these memories aren't effectively stored elsewhere in the brain, or it could be that neural traces persist but aren't able to be called back up. This second idea is out there, but there's some evidence for it, Turk Brown says. Scientists have successfully reactivated infant memories in mice by stimulating specific memory-related nerve cells. It's possible that there may be fragments of early memories still in the brain that could be reactivated later in life with the right kinds of cues. He likens the process to an unsuccessful internet search. The search terms your brain is using to access the memory are wrong or different from what they were when you initially stored the memory, Turk Brown and his colleagues are reporting. They are now studying how long babies' memories might last. Babies form memories like adults do in the Department of Neuroscience. From the Department of Animals, the story of dire wolves goes beyond de-extinction by Megan Rosen. Their names are Romulus, Remus, and Khaleesi, and they're the first dire wolves to walk the earth in over 10,000 years, or so one biotech company and a flurry of recent headlines say. Colossal Biosciences announced in April of this year the world's first de-extinction, the births of three dire wolves, extinct animals that lived during the ice ages of the Pleistocene. The pups were instant icons. With snowy white coats and muscular bodies, they looked like they could have walked straight out of the TV series Games of Thrones. News reports heralded the animals as scientifically seismic and said, "The dire wolf is back." And by the way, that is spelled D-I-R-E, dire. Some scientists aren't buying it. That is no more a dire wolf than I am Wonder Woman, says Jacqueline Gill, a paleoecologist at the University of Maine in Orono. The issue boils down to genetics. Colossal didn't create the animals from a fully reconstructed dire wolf genome. Instead, the company relied on the genome of a gray wolf, Canis lupus, making changes to it based on ancient DNA recovered from specimens of two dire wolves. For something to be a dire wolf, it would have the full genetic blueprint of a dire wolf, Gill says. Colossal has simply created a genetically modified gray wolf. That type of thinking misses the point, says Beth Shapiro, chief science officer of Colossal. The Dallas-based company's goal was to resurrect the animal's core attributes, like size, body type, and face shape. By making a handful of genetic changes, we've brought back these extinct genes to life in a living animal, she says. I'm happy to call that a dire wolf. And a new preprint counters one common critique of the work, showing that dire wolves may be more closely related to modern wolves than previously thought. Colossal is no stranger to controversy. Earlier this year, the company garnered acclaim with its announcement of woolly mice, luxuriously dressed mice with genetic modifications inspired by woolly mammoths. The rodents' golden brown fluff made them internet stars, but some scientists were skeptical that such a creation brought the field any closer to bringing back woolly mammoths. I think they're creating interesting zoo-like novelties, says wildlife geneticist Paul Wilson of Trent University, Ontario, in Peterborough. Even so, he finds the company's technology impressive. There's a huge range of applications, both for medicine and conservation, of endangered species, he says. Long before Romulus Remus and Khaleesi made their debut, dire wolves roamed the Americas during the Pleistocene epoch, which stretched from about 2.5 million years ago to 12,000 years ago. Ancient DNA from two of these animals informed the new pup's biology. Colossal scientists extracted DNA from a 13,000-year-old fossilized tooth and from a 72,000-year-old inner ear bone fossil. It can be tough to get a real clear read of an animal's genome from ancient DNA. As soon as an animal dies, its long strands of DNA start getting chopped up into tiny pieces, like confetti, Shapiro says. But by lining up billions of these snippets in a computer and comparing them with the genome of a gray wolf, scientists got an idea of what makes the animals different. The team used this information to identify genetic tweaks that might make the gray wolf more dire wolf-like. Altogether, the team made 20 edits to the genomes of gray wolf cells in the lab. Then it removed the DNA-packed nuclei of those cells and transferred them into denucleated dog egg cells, which developed into embryos. Researchers implanted the embryos into surrogate hounds, which gave birth via C-section, twin males Romulus and Remus, born in October, and a female, Khaleesi, born 4 months later. The gene editing technology itself is exciting, Gill says, but the problem now is that the public is going to believe that an animal that lived 10,000 years ago is back, and it is definitely not. Critics of Colossal's work have been vocal about dire wolves not being wolves at all. That argument seems to be based on a 2021 Nature paper that reconstructed the animal's evolutionary history. Scientists analyzed the genomes of 5 dire wolves and concluded that though the animals looked similar to gray wolves, they forged separate evolutionary paths nearly 6 million years ago. We thought that there was enough genetic divergence that they should not be in the genus Canis, says vertebrate paleontologist Julie Meakin of Des Moines University in Iowa. Canis is the group that includes wolves, dogs, and coyotes. But those analyses were based on low-quality DNA sequences. Colossal scientists re-extracted DNA from 2 of the original samples, making a more comprehensive dire wolf genome. The work suggests that dire wolves are more wolf-like than once thought, though still distantly related. Shapiro's team reports in a study that has yet to be peer-reviewed. I'm not sure if they'll be put back into the Canis group, says Meakin, who is listed as a co-author. In her opinion, the hubbub around the dire wolf project has overshadowed the importance of Colossal's technology, which could help save endangered species like the red wolf, Canis rufus. Fewer than 20 red wolves roam North America, and all are descended from about 12 individuals. That means the wolves lack genetic diversity, which increases the risk of health problems in descendants. Scientists identified a group of canines on the Gulf Coast of Louisiana and Texas that are genetically similar to red wolves. These red ghost wolves, as Colossal calls them, carry some ancestral red wolf DNA that's been lost in red wolf populations. Colossal cloned 4 animals from red ghost wolf cells. Those pups could one day be added to the wild red wolf population to boost genetic diversity, says Matt James, Colossal's chief animal officer. Or scientists could edit ancestral genes into red wolves to help them be more adaptable to climate change and disease and all the challenges that wild species face, he says. The story of dire wolves goes beyond de-extinction, is in the Department of Animals. And finally, a book review from the June 2025 issue of Science News. Why Silly Science is Valuable by Karen Kwan. The review is of The Salmon Cannon and the Levitating Frog. written by Carly Ann York, published by Basic Books. What's the purpose of your study? It's the question many basic science researchers dread, and it's one that Carly Ann York received about 10 years ago as a PhD student studying squid biomechanics. When a fellow Virginia Zoo volunteer, a retired Army officer, probed why taxpayer dollars should be spent on silly science, quote-unquote, all York could do was mutter about the inherent value of knowledge. Today, York, an animal physiologist at Lenoir Rhine University in Hickory, North Carolina, recognizes that immediate application is not the goal of basic science. Rather, it seeks to fundamentally understand natural phenomena. That doesn't mean the research is worthless. As York details in her book, The Salmon Cannon and the Levitating Frog, projects that could seem silly or useless can unwittingly lead to scientific advances that better our lives. Take sea fireflies. Studying the tiny crustacean's mysterious glow had been considered difficult and unpredictable. But in 1956, Japanese chemist Osamu Shimomura isolated a molecule behind the phenomenon. That feat attracted the attention of a U.S. researcher who recruited Shimomura to help study luminescent jellyfish. The team uncovered two proteins responsible for the jellyfish's glow, a quarin and a green fluorescent protein. The groundbreaking work revolutionized biological research and medicine. Doctors now use green fluorescent protein to better visualize and avoid nerves during surgery, as well as to track the spread of cancer cells in the body. The discovery earned Shimomura the 2008 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. The book reminds us that it's impossible to predict the path and outcome of basic science projects. It is an especially timely reminder as the U.S. government cuts science funding today. And Karen Kwan's review of The Salmon Cannon and the Levitating Frog, written by Carly Ann York, appears in the June 2025 issue of Science News. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.